think a lot of education around what AI is capable and not capable of and what the pros and cons are is needed, not just for us as doctors, but for patients and just really people everywhere.
We think nephrologists are already leading the charge, and we want to continue to lead the charge in how AI is used.
I think the most important thing is the accountability aspect of it.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks from Duke University. And today we'll be discussing everything about artificial intelligence. We're joined by Dr. Navdeep Tangri, who is a member of the Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence to Improve Kidney Care Workgroup for ASN, to really dive deep into what is ASN thinking about artificial intelligence.
I'm Nav Tangri. I'm a physician scientist in Canada. I work at the University of Manitoba, and I've been working in kidney health and chronic kidney disease epidemiology and clinical trials for more than a decade, and actually in machine learning and artificial intelligence for almost two decades. And I'm delighted to be a part of this work group that I'm representing here today and to help shape the ASN effort on bringing our members to a leadership scale and leadership spot in the use of artificial intelligence.
It's really great to see ASN bring this group together. As everyone knows, artificial intelligence is everywhere in all parts of our life, including our professional and our private lives too. So tell us first about the creation of this work group. Who are the members and what kind of constituents, and why ASN decided it was time to do this?
I think there's sort of this moment, right? There's the OpenAI ChatGPT moment. And then I think very quickly after this moment, we see the world is different than the world before it. It's like the Google moment or the internet moment, except it's the ChatGPT moment in this era, right? And so ASN is looking at this moment and thinking, hey, this is coming a mile a minute, and we need to be ahead of it and not behind it. So the ASN put out a desire to have a group and a champion for the group. And there was already an ongoing ASN effort on machine learning and on digital health. And so there was some of the skeleton was still very much there. But the idea was to form a work group that's going to catalyze this and take it to the next step. I, being passionate about this topic and area, applied. And then together with Todd Ibrahim and Melissa West, who was integral to the group, we came and we helped set the first committee or to set the first membership. Now, it's really important that we had broad stakeholder representation, right? So members in our work group come with expertise in almost every area of applied in artificial intelligence. There's Len Nosevieth, who's the head of Renal Research Institute, who is just a world-class machine learning and predictive AI expert and has been working with massive data sets and real applications of AI in kidney health for more than a couple of decades. And then there's Karandeep Singh, as an example, who's the chief AI officer at University of California, San Diego, who's helping decide and evaluate what AI solutions go into this mega health system at an enterprise level. There are also members from the value-based care community, such as Carmen Peralta. There's Lily Chan, who's a researcher in predictive and artificial intelligence. And then I cannot forget key members like Amy Waterman, who's been championing ethics in AI, and Wissit Chingpasitporn, who's a leading medical educator in this field. So you can see it's a very diverse group of people, and we all bring a unique and very collaborative expertise to this group. In my world, Matt, I'm just barely like the orchestra conductor in a way, right? The people are so good. I don't need to have a lot of input. They are determining the trajectory, and I think we're succeeding because the members are so good.
I saw that you already had a conference in New York, which is impressive to get that done so quickly. I also want to point out the timeline, and I just looked it up. ChatGPT came out November 30th, 2022, and you can see how this has been just skyrocketed in trying to figure out how we're going to use artificial intelligence in our daily lives. So maybe we can talk a little about the overarching goal of the group. What does this work group, if you were to say the first thing that you want to accomplish, what is that?
Stepping way back, I think of ASN as the professional organization for nephrologists and the nephrology community, right? Just like I think of another great organization like the NKF as the organization for patients with kidney disease, right? So let's talk about ASN. So from my view, we need to be the place where nephrology professionals go for advice and training in artificial intelligence. That's our overarching goal. We want to be the point of contact or the point of coordination for people who are coming out of training, people who are in training, and people who've been practicing for a decade or more on how they should use AI in their professional lives. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to provide them the tool set, the principles, and ongoing and engaging content to help them use this technology to make their professional lives easier and faster.
I think that's, there's so many different ways to talk about it. Let's talk about in daily life and taking care of patients. Let's say you have a patient that presents to you a constellation of problems, some lab values. How can a provider use that information to make a better diagnosis, a better care plan for their patient?
That's a great point. So I think that that constellation of problems is a good thought up for and a good way to get into both predictive and generative AI. So predictive AI is sort of machine learning applications, could be regression or it could be another model that takes a set of input variables and tries to make a prediction. And generative AI is really about generating new text, right? It's a large language model at the heart of it, but it's taking information you've given it and generated some new information based on that. So from a predictive AI perspective, the provider can use tools or algorithms or models that have been built to improve the diagnosis or prognostication for this patient in front of you, right? And there are tools like this that exist. And then from a generative AI perspective, there could be uses in the scribe that's on and present with consent in the room to record that conversation. Then there could be a clinical decision support tool that's either includes, let's say, the KDIGO guidelines or the ASN guidance. And then there may be a charting tool or a patient summary tool that then synthesizes all of that into a clinic note as well as a summary for the patient. So you can see how both predictive and generative AI can play into the care of a patient with chronic kidney disease. And we could produce a similar example for someone on dialysis, someone with AKI, and someone with a kidney transplant. And the reason I want to bring this up is if you read through our paper, it's oriented that way. It's oriented as CKD, AKI, dialysis, transplant, education, because we want the use of AI in nephrology to follow a clinical orientation and not the other way around. We didn't break the paper up into predictive and generative AI. We broke it up by clinical.
I think one of the challenges, though, is there's a lot of different tools to use it, and there's maybe risks associated with it. For instance, putting PHI into a AI system. So how does a provider make sure that they're not doing something that might put them at risk and also ensure that they're following all the rules surrounding AI?
So I think this is another great place where ASN can help educate, right? If we provide this type of guidance right in training and to practicing physicians, then I think we're really doing the right service. And there's two sides to that, right? There's a whole side about not putting in PHI and also using an approved tool if you work in a particular health system. And there's also the other side that even with an approved tool, realizing that tools make mistakes and realizing that you ultimately have to take ownership as the physician and to learn when to rely on tools and when not to rely on tools. And again, learning those strengths and limitations is part of where ASN can fill the gap for practicing providers.
I think that's the challenge, is I think it's so new. Oftentimes, people don't know when they've crossed the line. Are those lines in the sand yet? Do we know when, you know, you've crossed the line and say, okay, this is right, okay, this is wrong? An example of that is maybe in the realm of research and writing articles. For a long time, we just would use Google to find different things or how to say different things. And now you can put a sentence or even a paragraph into an AI learning machine. So what are the lines and have they been drawn yet?
This is a great question because actually most of my own personal professional life is largely in research and writing papers and making slides and doing presentations, right? So I've learned through practice that here are the red lines that in scientific writing that you can't cross. So one, I think you should not use an AI tool for the entirety or the majority of scientific writing, right? So absolutely, you cannot have AI writing your scientific papers. And if you do, you're taking a significant risk, because I think most journals have very good policies about that now. Now, what if you're a non-native speaker and you've written a section or a paragraph or two paragraphs or a page, and you want to improve the quality of the writing from a grammar, style, sentence perspective, right? What I would recommend is that first you disclose that it was used for this and check with the journal that you're submitting to. And second, you always try to maintain a track changes and a non-track changes version, right? And see what the change, so that you could transparently see every change that was made. From figures, absolutely zero manipulation of scientific figures is suggested and recommended, and I would strongly agree, particularly when it comes to if you think about basic science data or even visualization of clinical research data. Now, however, if you use an AI tool to create a flowchart is technically, you know, it's a figure, but it's not really a figure. It's just a representation of data in an algorithmic way, and you disclose that this flowchart was used, created using AI, that might be acceptable. But again, there are a few guiding principles. Disclosure is a key guiding principle. Whenever you use the AI in any part of the scientific writing process, you must disclose. The second part is that you must disclose exactly what you did with it, not just that AI was used. AI was used to review the writing or to generate a flowchart or generate a table. So I think disclosure's got to be very clear. And the same holds true, I think, for slides, right? Like, I love a tool called Notebook LM. And your fellows may have been using Notebook LM. Notebook LM makes beautiful slides, absolutely beautiful slides. But you got to disclose that you use Notebook LM to make these slides. You can't just pass them off as your own slides.
They often look too nice and very obviously, sometimes too distracting. You're like, wow, that's absolutely gorgeous what that made.
Yeah. And the nice thing is that if you think it's too distracting, you could just talk to Notebook LM and say, make it less distracting, you know, make it less dense. It'll usually do that. So I think that, and you're seeing this in training, right? In journal club presentations. So what would be a good and a bad in a journal club, right? A good would be perhaps the use of AI to make some slides about the content of the article and verify them with the gold standard source of the article. Bad would be use AI to do the interpretation of the biases, the strengths, and the limitations of the article. Because then you've learned nothing, right? The facts are the facts. You don't need to learn what's in table one. You don't need to learn what's in figure two. You can use AI to make a slide about table one and figure two. But you do need to learn critical appraisal, right? And an AI tool should not be your critical appraisal. It should not be peer review. This is where we need to draw the lines. And whether that's at journal clubs at an academic institution or even at a journal itself, like the ASN journals, if you should not be relying on an AI peer review.
I just got back from National Kidney Foundation, and I'm seeing more and more talks from esteemed colleagues incorporating more and more AI. And it's very interesting to see that just in 3 or 4 short years of its existence. Let's move to institutional policies. And I've seen that some institutions have partnered with, very commonly, Copilot, where you log in to your account. And so is that make it a safer thing to use? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So I think, and this is largely because of Microsoft's reach and existing agreements with institutions. So Copilot may be integrated with your Office package, where it can read into your Outlook and come. Brings up an interesting point, right? Like, if Copilot reads your email and then drafts a response, it often tends to be quite wordy, doesn't sound like a real human, and most of us can now tell it apart. And probably the person on the other end is going to think it's a bit cringe. So whether that's a policy or not, I encourage people to write your own emails rather than using Copilot. That's not really a red line. Your institution won't care, but I'll think your email is cringe. So I think that's certainly safe. Now, part of the issue is that I would encourage institutions to find a way rather than restrict. Because I think people want to use the best tools. And this is not me in any way or the ASN committee in any way saying use tools outside of what your institution recommends. You should only use what your institution does, but your institution and the chief AI officers at your institution should be removing barriers that allow you to use the best tools. So we don't pick any winners, right? At ASN, we don't say use X tool or use Y tool or Z tool. But let's say Claude is an excellent tool, but your institution uses Copilot, hypothetically speaking, right? But a lot of the physicians want to use Claude. My belief is that if you become overly restrictive and you say, no, no, you can only use this one approved tool, that's when you start to see data leakage and information going out to other tools, right? Because people don't want to use an inferior tool when they think a superior tool is out there. So that's not to say that we encourage people to do that, but rather we encourage institutions to remove the barriers and let people use the best tools.
It seems that oftentimes there's a rubric for like what your use is and then what they will allow. For instance, if you're giving a presentation, you can use what you want. But if you start venturing into research and patient care type of things, they get a little bit more restrictive on that. Is that a common theme, or is that just as we get started, you're going to see more restrictive policies?
I think that's a good thing, to be honest, because I think that we have to identify lower risk settings and higher risk settings, right? So creating a bunch of slides, while we agree on the guardrails of the slides and disclosures, is a lower risk setting, right? Because often it's based on existing data that's already out there, right? And you're published.
It might be cringe, but it's probably safe.
It's probably safe, exactly. But doing like anything that involves, let's say, intellectual property or patient health information, the institution probably is considering that as higher risk. And therefore, it's appropriate for them to put some more guardrails around it. The AI industry is a bit young, right? It's only, like I said, November 22 was the moment. And you and I are both aware of copyright lawsuits, right? There's authors who would say their work has been used to train models without their permission. So it's probably not the industry with the greatest actors in the world, right? And we know well from, both of us have children, we know the social media industry, also not the best actors in the world, right? So I think it's okay for us to be restrictive because in this gold rush moment in technology, right, often rules are going to be broken. And perhaps if we don't have some of these safeguards in place, it'll be a long time before we realize that the rules were broken. And so I think for more sensitive information, for higher risk information, it's okay to be safe.
When some of the different tools for social media first came out, they were free to use. And I almost think they're trying to get just people there. And now it's becoming more pay for play. Do you think that will also happen in AI? Right now, I think they're limiting like how many figures you can make and say, well, after this, you can't make any more till tomorrow. I'm sure in the future, it will be like, you can't even use this unless you are a subscribing member. Is that where we're moving?
Very much so. I think this is the tech model, and I suspect that this will play out again, right? And we already have examples, right? We have Open Evidence, for example, is the number one tool at the moment in terms of users for clinical questions. And Open Evidence has ads. I see a scenario unfolding where there will be a free versions of these tools, which will, in fact, won't be free. It's just that the cost will be your data and you having to see ads on your data.
So basically, if you're searching for certain things, it'll start sending you ads for anything related to kidney disease.
Yeah. Or for example, if you're searching for a recipe, right, there may be an embedded link in there to say, here, click this to buy this from Whole Foods at Amazon or something like that, right?
We see that in our daily lives all the time.
Yeah. Do we need more? I'm not sure we need more, right? We don't need more ads in our lives. And I think that this is unfortunately where this tension will go, because these tools do consume a lot of energy, right? A query, even a simple question on a GPT or an LLM consumes way more energy than a regular Google search. So the energy equals cost. We're getting deep and philosophical here. I like that. This is, we started out with the ASN's mandate, and now we're getting way out there. Some of these companies have $20 billion in revenue and yet are losing $10 to $15 billion a year. It goes to show that the cost of running these models and the data centers that are being built everywhere, right, and the chips that are being consumed are still not at cost recovery. So in the end, unfortunately, what that does is it leads to ads.
I mean, money is definitely what runs the world. Let's just bring it back a little bit and talk about ASN's mandate again. And maybe in more simple terms, you know, really for us to succeed as a field, we have to lead. So what will it take for nephrology to lead in AI?
This is a part where ASN is very clear and our committee is very clear. We want leaders. We know there are nephrologist leaders at every major institution, right? We know there are leaders who are nephrologists who are leading either administration or education or research at different institutions. There are a million names, and you're gonna forgive me if I miss a couple of names, because I just want to, for simplicity, state a couple, right? Anupam Agarwal is a dean in a UAB, is a nephrologist, right? Matt, you're a leader in medical education. You're a nephrologist, right? There's people in research, in education, in administration, at major institutions. So I talk about Karandeep Singh in our committee, Chief AI Officer at UCSD, a nephrologist. Girish Nadkarni, Chief AI Officer at Sinai, a nephrologist, right? We should be stepping up and driving AI policy at our major hospitals and institutions and in our curriculum in medical education, right? Because, and we talked briefly about this example a little bit earlier, right? Let's say there's 10 different clinical decision support tools. We already know there are. There's Open Evidence, UpToDate, Doximity. And let's say one or two of them are really good at nephrology and one or two of them are really bad at nephrology. If we don't make our voices heard, our institution will just pick one. And we may get stuck with the really bad one or the really good one, and it'll just be random. So this is why we think nephrologists should be leading the conversations. And ASN wants to equip its membership to do that. So how do we do that? We do conferences where we teach firsthand how to use AI tools. We sponsor research conferences, like we just did one at UAB and UCSD, where we encourage new studies using AI tools in kidney disease. And we're working towards an ASN AI pre-course to be a regularly scheduled event at Kidney Week. And we're working towards webinars and podcasts that'll be enduring and timely and scheduled that will continue to keep us on the leading edge.
It sounds like for all of us who's listening to this, just get involved. Get involved at your institution, get involved in the organization that you're in. Your voice matters. And if your institution starts to move in a certain direction without that voice, we could be left behind.
Yeah, we totally agree. And we want people to be get involved within ASN, within our committee, and also within our ASN AI community, which Wisit and Corinne Bergling from RRI have been heading. It's actually a really vibrant place to have a good discussion. You know, recently there's a paper every month about how AI is better than doctors. And we need to discuss those papers on the ASN community because we need to have our voice on that. And all these papers are deeply flawed, right? These are papers where there's a distilled transcript of data about the size of a book of a patient encounter given to an LLM and given to a physician, as if we practice medicine like this, right? So that's what we need to call out in this community. And so we need to have a voice, I think.
I'm almost hearing a little bit of skepticism in that discussion. And I think one thing I want to hear from your committee, yes, embracing AI and thinking about how to augment it, but also, should we also have a little bit of degree of skepticism about the output in which they're generating these recommendations or whatever they're doing?
100%. Let's not forget that we're a member representative organization who looks after nephrologists and who represents nephrologists. And so if there is biased and slanted experiments out there that are saying that an AI can replace a physician or replace a nephrologist, we need to be out there and advocating that that's not the case. We think a nephrologist using an AI tool may work faster, may work better, and it may improve their professional life and may improve their personal life, but that's not our primary concern. It may improve their professional life, but we do not view AI as a replacement for nephrologists or nephrology work in any way.
I think we're getting close to time. I want to hear if there's any last comments that you want to make.
This has really been a great conversation. I know we left off and went to 50,000 feet for a while, but thanks for bringing us back right down to the mandate of the ASN and this committee. And sometimes going to 50,000 feet is good for podcasting, right? And it's good that we have these open, flowing conversations because you and I have known each other for a long time. I think you summed it up well when you looked up the date, that there's a reason this is coming at a mile a minute, and there's a reason ASN has put this committee together. We do not see nephrologists getting left behind. I didn't want to say we don't want nephrologists. We don't see it. We think nephrologists are already leading the charge, and we want to continue to lead the charge in how AI is used. And we will always see it as supporting nephrologists and never replacing them.
This is such an exciting area, and I appreciate you and all of the work groups work in this really important area. And I'm just really excited to see where it goes with a healthy degree of skepticism.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. And always great to talk with you and see you again.
We're joined by Dr. Lily Chan to talk about her paper called Smart Learning, Artificial Intelligence in Kidney Disease Education, published in the Trainee Spotlight, CJSN. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation.
Thanks, Matt. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
This is a complete episode talking about AI, and AI is everywhere. And I think this is a great paper because it succinctly goes through AI in many of the facets that we're going to be using it in our daily lives as nephrologists. So first, maybe I can hear a little bit about what was your sort of take on how you were going to approach this article when you started it.
I think what you said is so correct. It's really changing how we practice, but also how we learn nephrology. Our fellows and trainees are more and more using AI in their clinical care, in preparing for their presentations. So we were really trying to think about how are some key uses of AI that fellows and trainees are using, and then also what levels of education and what do people really need to know about AI in their clinical practice, and what are things that you have to watch out for. So that's how we kind of came up with our different topics for our paper.
One of the topics we have not really talked about on this podcast is patient education, and I see it coming in several ways. One is just looking for large language models that you can find like ChatGPT or many others. Or second, I saw a really interesting post from, I think it was Cedar Sinai, that was partnering with Open Evidence, to where it looked like Open Evidence was able to look at the patient's chart and then provide patient education to the patient, which I had not seen that before. So maybe we just talk in brief, like, where are we with providing patient education using AI?
I think we're still trying to explore that, to be honest. And I think there's a lot to be figured out. I think on the one side is how can we use AI to make more patient-friendly handouts or information to help them understand the complex concepts or diseases that we're talking about. And then on the second side is how do we teach patients to use AI to facilitate their own care? Because I think more and more we are seeing patients actually come in with things they've looked up on ChatGPT or Gemini and asking the providers, like, how is this appropriate for me? Is this what I should be doing? And then really talking through recognizing that some of this output is not always correct, and encouraging them to bring that to us and talk through what should be and shouldn't be doing in their own care.
One of the things that makes me worried about this is, do you see a time in which basically pharmaceutical companies will be directly advertising their drug on a large language model, which may or may not be appropriate for the patient as they're searching different conditions?
That is a really interesting question. I really hope not. I hope that there was quite a bit of restrictions, even on pharmaceutical companies doing commercials in magazines and on streaming networks and on TV. But I do see that as a potential market. I will also say some of the large language models that we're using, like Open Evidence, they do have advertisements from different pharma companies and drugs. So it is already starting up on that end. I don't know if it'll ever go to the patient side, but it is happening.
I can see where a patient will get a printout and say, wow, this is what I should take. I almost see it, maybe you can speak to this, is that occasionally I can see where a patient might look at a large language model and believe it more than their doctor, and that could create problems. The large language models look very authoritative. They look like they're the truth. How can we ensure that the information they're getting actually is just information and not, hey, this is what your doctors recommend.
Yeah, that's a really good point and a really important question and a topic that we, I think, as clinicians need to be really careful of. I will say most large language models do often disclose that they are larger language models and they should not be giving medical advice and this should not be taken as medical advice and that they should seek help, right? However, I think it also comes down to us maintaining and building those patient-doctor communications and trust such that people do feel comfortable bringing the advice they're getting from large language models to us to have these open discussions. What we don't want happening is, and that is already happening, is that people are taking the advice from large language models and doing it without seeking medical expert help. And this has led to adverse outcomes. For example, there was a recent article that was shared by our members on the ASN communities page about a person who took an over-the-counter medication that was 3 times the dose of what was actually recommended and ended up with a severe acute kidney injury in the hospital. And I think this is more going to impact people who don't have access to healthcare or are limited to access to healthcare because it's easier to go to a large language model and get advice than to seek a healthcare provider.
What can we do as a community to try to make it to where the patients can benefit from AI, but also mitigate the risk?
I really think we need to do broad education about AI's capabilities and reinforce that right now these models are trained with almost everything available on the internet. And most people know that you can't trust around half of what we see on the internet because it's not real or it's made or it's a very skewed view, right? So while I am a huge AI user, I am a huge proponent that we should all be using AI, I also hold a healthy dose of skepticism towards the output. And I'm always constantly looking to validate that output. And I think that's really the key step is that don't always trust what it's producing and giving you, that we also need to double check it and fact check it. And whether that be looking for primary sources or asking other people for advice who might be experts in that specific field is going to be really important. So I think a lot of education around what AI is capable and not capable of and what the pros and cons are is needed, not just for us as doctors, but for patients and just really people everywhere.
The next area I wanted to talk about was medical education, something that I have a deep interest in, but also AI is there to help people learn. You can find the information. A couple of things I found interesting about the manuscript is they talked about a few concepts. One was called de-skilling and one was called never-skilling. Can you talk about what those are and why AI sometimes can be a risk for learners?
Absolutely. I think these are really critically important concepts. So the idea of never-skilling is that if a person, let's say a medical student, very early on starts using the AI, for example, their clinical reasoning or clinical judgment, then they become over-reliant on AI and they just take the AI output without never actually developing the skills of diagnostic reasoning that they would have because they're no longer thinking through it. So you're now giving the AI the power to think for you. So they never learn those skills that they'll need later on. And it's really critical to learn these early on when there's going to be somebody who will be there to help you think through things and point out when you're wrong, while when you go into independent practice, you're not going to have that, right? And then the de-skilling part is we are now using AI so much, like we have those skills, but now we're using AI so much that we're actually losing those skills. And there was a little bit of journalism work on some podcasts from the New York Times that I also read that interviewed coders. And even the coders are now using a lot of different AI agents to write their code for them. And these are mid-career or senior career engineers who are recognized that now that they are not doing it, they would have a difficult time doing it from scratch. So that's the same thing for doctors, right? If we stop doing something that we used to do hundreds of times a week, we might end up losing those skills that are necessary for us to care for our patients.
So one of the concepts that can help to put that together is what's called co-learning. Can you describe how someone would use AI as a co-learning approach?
Yeah, I think it's recognizing how to fit AI into their kind of learning, recognizing that it can help them, but not becoming over-reliant, and also the need to constantly check that you yourself also have those concepts ingrained before just depending on AI for it. And also constantly checking that you still retain those skills and that you become over-reliant and just cede all of that power to AI.
So listening to this, I think we want to have a world where we can utilize AI to help in co-learning, not to de-skill or never skill. But maybe is it possible that with the appropriate use of AI, someone might be able to advance their education even faster than we did, say, when we were fellows?
Oh, 100%. I think the access to information now is much easier. You can use AI and create study questions. You can help it create flow charts to understand things and concepts, study cards. AI can be so useful in helping with some mundane tasks that we previously would not have had access to. It can also provide, there's a whole concept of precision education, and help us also recognize where our weaknesses are and where our gaps potentially are so that we can focus our efforts to address those weaknesses. So there's a lot of opportunity there. It's just about using it in a way that, again, helps you and doesn't take away from your learning.
Another area that learners are using AI is in their presentations. For instance, their case reports or grand rounds. What advice do you have for fellows and residents about how to use AI to enhance your presentation and not take away from everything that you're trying to convey when you're giving a presentation?
Absolutely. I use AI all the time now to put together my presentations because it does makes my figures nicer than I have. But I always start from something. I always have a draft in mind, and I don't just tell AI to output something for me, because then it's still more genuine and the concepts are still there. I also defer to each institution for their rules and regulations and policies around AI usage. But our institution is very firm that it is up to the discretion of each program director and each course director. But regardless, if you use AI, you have to disclose that you used AI. And I do think it can make your presentations look much more cohesive. But if you're not using it carefully and you're not overseeing it, it can also look very messy, because each figure, if you're not careful with it, each figure looks very different from another, or the figures could even be wrong. I've had a lot of language errors. They'll reproduce bar plots that are not the same as the journal ones, or that they don't make any sense. And that just looks really messy, and I think is a disservice to both you and the AI. So if you're going to use it, you have to be really careful. You have to validate each thing. And it also doesn't take away from when you're delivering the presentation, you still need to know the article you're talking about. AI can't give you that knowledge. You still have to obtain that yourself.
What about programs? I see Notebook LM being widely used. Are there any others that you recommend or that you've dabbled in and think are worth checking out?
I think the really popular ones right now, obviously, are the ChatGPT and Geminis for general large language models. I use Notebook LM a lot. I think it makes really nice infographics. It also can make slides. I've also used Napkin AI quite a bit. So how Napkin works is you put in a thought and it'll generate a figure for you. There's free versions and paid versions that will give you more customization. So I like to use that. I think clinicians are often using Open Evidence, and we just recently went into a business agreement with Open Evidence, and now it's integrated into our Epic. And I believe you also probably saw the big announcement about Cedars-Sinai's work collaboration with Open Evidence to deliver more personal patient-centered care, and that it's integrated into each patient now. DocSymmetry also has a free one. It's called DocsGPT. So anyone who has an MPA and a DocSymmetry account can also use that. And that one's fun because if you've never tried and you're thinking about getting ambient AI at your center, they actually have an ambient AI that you can play around with just to see how that works. I wouldn't use it actually for patient care unless you have an agreement or something in place, but it might just allow you to practice and see how it is before something actually is instituted or if you're considering it. So those are the ones I probably use all the time. Many people who are also coding use Claude. And on the horizon also is just, I think a few weeks ago, ChatGPT also now has a clinician version, which is supposed to be free for all US clinicians with an NPI number. And I think it's very similar to Open Evidence. I haven't had a chance to play around with it. It's still pretty new, but I think it's supposed to be very similar that it's anchored to specific journals and scientific literature and medical literature, again, following that Open Evidence model.
I always look at medical education as a curve. Some people are all in on new things, many are in the middle, and some are big skeptics. And I'm sure AI follows that same trend.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me, how do you approach someone who's on that other end where they are not interested in getting involved in AI? And are there any risks to them standing back and watching this develop? Should everyone be getting in, or do we still need the skeptics to stand on the other side?
I think you need a little bit of skepticism. All of us need some skepticism because it's not perfect. And we need to know and recognize that it's not going to be 100%. But we as humans are also not going to be 100% correct either, right? But what I am concerned about is if you don't use it, then you're it's at the cost of kind of your own detriment, because you're going to sacrifice efficiency. You're going to sacrifice ease of obtaining knowledge and sharing knowledge. So there is a lot of benefits to the AI. And what we've also done, a lot of faculty development seminars here at Sinai, career development seminars, to bring people recognizing what these large language models are capable of and not capable of, to kind of turn that skepticism into, okay, I can still be a skeptic, but I can still know how to use these tools and use these tools for specific tasks that I hate doing, but that AI might be great at doing.
So you think there's going to be a time where there's really no choice? You're going to have to embrace AI.
I think so. It's all over many people's electronic health records. It's in our Amazon shopping. If you try to do a Google search, there's a Gemini response. That's the first thing that shows up. And so I think it's going to be really difficult to avoid, not impossible, but difficult. We still have, just like how most of us use smartphones, but there are some people who still use flip phones. That'll likely be what happens.
That's, I think, 100% true. Maybe in the future, you'll just have deliveries at your front door because AI knows your shopping habits and what you've done the last several years, and brings all that to you and don't even have to leave the house.
Absolutely.
And the same way as we are physicians, there are certain patients we see and we do things, and AI will be able to tell you, here's the type of patients you're typically seeing. And I always find it interesting that when you see the data, oftentimes different than your perception. Mm-hmm. And that's where quality improvement might be aided by. Getting this data has been hard, and maybe now we can actually get it. I always think about the EMR and this promise that you could just click a button and then everything is there. It hasn't really happened. Do you think that's where AI will also help us in getting data for our patients that we take care of?
Yeah, especially for patients who may have been in the healthcare system for years and years, and we as humans can only go so far back. But AI can look through, scour for us, and create a really nice summary. That's already out there. That's already AI tools in our electronic health record. It's not a when, it's already here. So the next step, I think, probably are the clinical decision support tools that are out there. They very mixed results right now. I think most of them really are not AI-based, but they're still rule-based. But the next step probably is AI models to help with that. And also AI models to help talk with patients through really difficult decisions or tricky procedures, and help them explain them, like kidney biopsies. How much time do we spend talking a patient through a kidney biopsy? Or is it like, you need a biopsy, this is what's going to happen, you have to show up here and someone's going to call you, right? But maybe the person has a lot of questions. And if you have questions, here's an AI bot, here's someone you can talk to, or quote unquote someone, but they will have abundance of patients and abundance of time that we as clinicians don't have in our 15-minute visit slots.
One last question before we close this episode of Kidney Translation. Give us an example of how AI has helped you in your professional career that you might have been surprised about.
Ooh, okay. I would say really presentations are where it's had the most impact for me. Recently, I was asked to give a grand rounds for an allergy and immunology. I am certainly not an expert in allergy and immunology, but I put the presentation together, and after I talked about these three big topics where AI could help with this, these clinical tasks, one of the questions from the audience was, if they had to do a presentation about nephrology, they would not be able to do it as well as I did for allergy and immunology, right? And I was just like, because I used AI, and when I had questions about the papers, I could just ask AI to explain the topics for me. And so it's not just about putting together a pretty presentation, but really understanding a topic that I am not an expert in, but making me sound good enough that I impress the actual experts. So
fantastic. Thank you so much. And thank you for this paper. I think this is a great addition for anyone to learn about AI in their daily life as a nephrologist.
Thank you so much, Matt. And I also want to give a shout out to my co-authors, Madhu Rajagopal and Pushkala Jayaraman, who are both trainees within our lab, who helped me tremendously on this article.
We're joined by a first author of an article in Kidney 360 titled, Confronting the Ethical Issues of Artificial Intelligence Use in Nephrology. We have Dr. Alison Waitman from Australia. Welcome to ASN Kidney Translation Podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm Ali. I'm from Adelaide in South Australia, and I'm a nephrologist. I work at the Royal Adelaide Hospital in Adelaide as a clinical nephrologist, and I'm also doing a PhD in ethics, specifically transplantation ethics. But as part of doing that PhD, I've also been doing some work in AI and ethics, because there's actually quite a bit of overlap, which surprised me at the time.
You cannot hide and not see artificial intelligence. When I looked at this paper, I said, wow, like almost an entire issue devoted to the ethical issues of AI. And I thought it would be just a great discussion to really talk about that in more depth. Maybe before we talk about the paper, how did this come about?
One of my supervisors, Simon Coughlin, his specialty area is AI and ethics. I already had some kind of expertise on my supervisory panel, but the article itself, I was invited to give a talk at the National Transplant Conference in Australia, the Transplant Society of Australia, New Zealand, TSANZ, back in 2024. And they asked me to speak about it. And given that I had Simon as part of my team, it then seemed to make sense to use some of the things that I had talked about in that talk to then turn it into an article. What has been very interesting to me is how much in the time between I gave that talk and when I published the article, how much the field has changed as well. It's been incredible how quickly it moves.
It really has, and it's hard to keep pace with everything that's happening. I'll say just on so many different fronts, from education to patient care to really all aspects of life, not just in medicine. What should we be worried about when we have these tools doing things for us? What are the downsides to it?
For me, the biggest thing we need to be considering is how the consumers or the patients feel about our using AI in whatever context it is. And the question around whether they consent to it as well, that I think it's more, and the studies have suggested it's more acceptable for these kind of back of house activities, like the administrative tasks. The public opinion in general is supportive of AI to reduce that administrative burden. But there's a lot more concern about using it where there's a direct interaction with the AI. So I'm thinking about there's a lot of skepticism and concern about using AI scribes, for example. There is a concern about using AI diagnostically and to make treatment plans and things like that. So I think that's one of the areas for me. I think that doctors are time pressured. We can think some of these things aren't as important, that particularly I see that with AI scribes, that it's reducing an administrative burden for the doctor, but it's something that patients have a lot of concern about and that should hold us back. I think some of the things that I raised in the article are being addressed, and that is one of the things about it it moving so quickly is that some of the problems, particularly with bias and also with accuracy, are continually improving as the technology is improved. But I think we also need to be cognizant that the computer can't be accountable to itself. The program can't be accountable to itself, that there has to be a human, a vendor of the decision-making, who takes the responsibility as well. I think that needs to be some of the governance around AI. It's the other thing that I think needs to be always in focus. And that's something that concerns me about AI, is that the governance can be a bit slow in catching up.
A company called Ambient AI is pretty ubiquitous and really moved quickly in the United States. I'm not sure how it is in Australia and other countries, but I also note that there are several lawsuits that have appeared over the last year, and most of them centered around informed consent. And I've seen that now, when I first came out, there wasn't a lot of discussion around it. But for instance, how many days the recording exists? Where is that data stored at? What about those other things that are discussed that might not be related to the visit? Where are those kept? And exactly how informed consent is had. Because if you don't explicitly have them sign something, this is the hard part, is like sometimes AI is popping up in places. And for instance, maybe the patient just thought they're being recorded. They didn't realize that an AI software was taking what they said and turning it into something different. How do we move forward with AI and become more trustworthy so that we don't have issues like these lawsuits?
I think a big part of it is people getting more familiar with the technology. So I think the ubiquitousness of it is helping in that regard, that people initially are aware of its existence and then also aware of the problems. Certainly we have AI scribes. We have a couple of different medical AI scribe companies in Australia. A main concern from the Australian public has been around data privacy. So I think if you are getting consent for it, we know that there's a lot of concern in the community, so we can't therefore defend sort of assumed consent. I think it does have to be explicit consent. But equally, it's really challenging to get fully informed consent, particularly because doctors are still learning about the different types of AI and what generative AI actually is, and that these programs are using something more than just voice to text, that it's actually a quite different technology altogether, and the implications that has. Part of, I think, overcoming some of this is also about directly educating both the sort of future doctors, medical students, and I think that's kind of the easy thing, but also for existing practitioners to have some kind of exposure to the different types of AI and what the particular problems are with each of them, so that when they are exposed to it in their workplace, you know, they come to work and someone says, all right, we're using digital scribes now, they can know when they're talking to patients about it what it actually is, and particularly what the risks of it are, so that they can then actually consent somebody, as opposed to just saying, I'm using a digital scribe, is that okay?
Maybe it's like we don't even know how to consent someone for it. We just say, hey, I'm using this AI scribe. And for the doctor, it's like, well, it's saving me time, but you need to let them know about, you know, how long this is going to be recorded. What are the actual softwares that's going to take our conversation and change it to something a little bit different? And so learning how to do that consent is very, very important. Your paper breaks down these ethical issues in several ways, and let's go through a few of them, but we'll talk about, at least mention them all. I think we've talked about the first one a little bit, the trustworthiness aspect of it, the accountability, privacy, the disclosure and consent. We've already mentioned a lot of these. One I want to discuss a little bit more is bias. And then I'll mention the other two, and we'll come back to bias. The next one is distributive justice, and then environmental ethics. So let's move on to bias. And I think this one really is, I think, really challenging, because as you describe in your paper, it's taking information that's biased and out there and using generative software and maybe making what was a little bit biased just continues to be more and more biased. Give us an example of how that could work in nephrology.
So when we are looking at the decisions that an AI program makes, it's only going to be as good as the data that it has access to. And we know that there are longstanding issues with how we collect data, who we include in clinical trials. Some of this touches on the distributive justice of the high socioeconomic countries versus middle and low socioeconomic countries. We know that the data, existing data that we have is incomplete. AI doesn't have the full picture when it's making recommendations about things and when it's analysing and coming up with outputs. And the other problem that we can run into is that and also reflect our own biases about things.
So what's an example of, I guess I'm trying to think of like triaging patients, which seems pretty straightforward. However, you could imagine a situation where the AI tool might not fully understand exactly the urgency of a particular patient because their data wasn't included in, you know, the randomized control trials for X, Y, or Z disease, and they might not be triaged appropriately, for instance. Is that an example of how that might work?
Yep, absolutely. We could, so hypothetically, the example that I had was of the inclusion of a racial element into the GFR calculator, and that was based on an assumption that there was actually a difference based on ethnicity in GFR between people, and that was a longstanding assumption that just got included into the AI algorithm, and actually that when it then got tracked back, it wasn't that the AI was just operating as it had been instructed to, but it included this assumption that was in fact incorrect, and that then led to a biased outcome. I think if I was thinking in terms of a triage, easy one would be that somebody who had incomplete data for some reason, and this would be more likely in people from lower resourced settings, perhaps people who are outside of major metropolitan centres, that we might not have access to all of their data, and therefore the algorithm would be less likely to identify that this person actually needed a more urgent spot. Similarly, if we weren't specific about what kind of things that we wanted to take into account when we were making a referral, hypothetically, someone could say, well, we want to reduce the number of appointments we have where patients aren't turning up, so we're not going to offer as many spots when we know it's unlikely that the patient is going to come in as a resource allocation decision. And then say, okay, AI algorithm, detect what are the risk factors that a patient's not going to turn up, and where those people aren't going to be allocated fewer spots. It's easy then to see that the people who might not be coming in might be, again, having to travel a long way for the appointment, might be from lower resourced areas, might not have the same social supports, things that might not be able to be captured. And that would create a biased outcome that we were inadvertently prioritising an advantaged group to get earlier appointments or things like that. But similarly, we can also use that in reverse. We can design programs to try and help us identify at-risk patients and then who aren't going to turn up to appointments, and so that we can introduce supports, if you like, to actually get them to appointments. Do we need to book them a different time? Do we need to book them a different place? Like, we can try and use the data to understand the barriers and then try and counteract them as well. So the bias can go both ways in that sense.
Well, obviously this is not going away. I mean, it's here and it's popping up everywhere. What are some ways in which we as nephrologists or physicians in general can ensure that this is done in a way that's proper, reduces bias, doesn't create disparities? How can we ensure that this is brought in to help us and not actually hurt us?
I think the most important thing is the accountability aspect of it, to have it clear whose job it is to check the outputs of the AI, and always remember that the buck stops with them, so that we don't become too complacent with it. I think we know that there are issues when we rely on it and we stop checking it quite so quickly. There are our own biases can make us blind to errors because we're overly trusting of it. So I think having a healthy degree of skepticism about the AI output such that you are always actually checking it. And also knowing when you are actually going to be the one responsible for whatever the output is versus when it's the hospital administration or somebody else is going to be responsible for that. The other thing is we need to sort of systematize that, if you like, so that we are auditing the outputs, so that we're looking at framing our audits to look for these potential pitfalls. So looking for, are we seeing bias? Are we seeing inaccuracy? If we are framing our audits so that we can try and detect these, because it might be hard on an individual level, we might need to go bigger picture.
I want to pivot the conversation a little bit more now to education. Obviously, AI is used often to learn about new things. And sometimes I look at it like this. Back when I was a fellow, you really had to work hard to get a paper. And so when you got that paper, you read that paper, it meant a lot more because it was so challenging to get that data. Now it's so easy. You can get anything in just a few clicks. And it seems that often that because of that, there's just a sea of information that you're flooded in, you can get to it really quickly, or you can even make AI make a presentation for you. How do we get to the point where learners can really know and understand and not just gather the information?
I think one of the exciting things about AI is its ability to just read more than any person could do and gather more information. So when we develop an approach to using AI as a tool, we've got to use its strengths. And then when we identify that it has weaknesses, supplement those. So I think when we are using it to, for example, review the literature, we don't just want it blindly reading everything, because there are papers that are stronger than others. There are flaws in data sets that we can detect that we don't want that being given the same weight. So part of it is curating kind of what the inputs are for the AI. And this is the harder bit, I suppose, is testing that the output. Does the output make sense? And it can be hard because we don't necessarily know how it came to particular conclusions. I think an important part of the education aspect is how to critically analyze what the AI has come out with so that you can know how heavily to rely on it. And a big part of that is knowing what information it took initially to come to whatever output it's come to.
It's like listening to your professor on rounds, and sometimes it's hard to, you know, you listen to them and you trust what they say. And I think sometimes AI is like that, where you listen to it or read it and you trust it. And that's the really challenging part, because you look at it as like, well, it knows everything, so it must know this. And I recall a patient that put their entire medical record into an AI tool, and it spit out recommendations. And that patient brought that to me and said, well, you know, this is what it's recommending. And one thing I noted was that the AI was not good at putting in multiple pieces of data together to make one recommendation. It was maybe prioritizing one piece of data over another. For instance, it was prioritizing the albuminuria over the GFR, and not realizing their GFR was so low that they couldn't take the medication safely. And that's one thing that I seem to notice, is that it will find one thing and really go after that. And that's the challenge, is trying to understand that. And I feel like sometimes a new learner, for instance, just joining a field, might not have that robust knowledge set to be able to question AI. And that's concerning.
Yes. And I think what has been demonstrated is physicians in particular are very susceptible to trusting AI recommendations and not interrogating them. Whereas in contrast, the general public has, it may well be shifting, but sort of in 5 years ago, had a lot more concern, was a lot more apprehensive about it. So, but it is hard when it makes it look so easy, this process that would have taken a long time, it can do in seconds, to just assimilate everything and say, this is what we should do. I think one of the other pitfalls is that AI isn't good at recognizing ambivalence, where it's actually not clear whether what the right thing to do is. And if something is 1% better than something else, AI will still say, absolutely, you should go for that because it is better. As opposed to a clinician might say, well, this is a bit of a line ball. We could go either way, what's going to work with you. I think it also highlights why doctors aren't going to be replaced by AI certainly anytime soon, is because there is still a real nuance in how we interpret data and how we personalize medicine for individuals that AI hasn't yet been able to capture. I think it is possible, and some programs do it, but to integrate all of that stuff in and say, you do have a lot of albuminuria, your GFR is not great, your social situation is this, your financial situation is this, maybe medically doing something, absolutely. I think the classic example would be recommending somebody to go on to, they're at the point of their diabetes, they should go on to insulin, but finding out they didn't have a fridge at home and they had no way of actually safely storing the insulin. So we could absolutely say medically that insulin's the right move here, and an AI might analyze the data and say, oh no, let's go insulin. But actually in the bigger picture, it's not going to work. And I don't think there's a program that's going to be able to capture that yet.
Some of the things that's great though is when you see a disease that maybe you haven't seen very often or the combination of things very often, you can quickly say, please find all the case reports of this. And it seems to do a lot better job than if you just were to go to PubMed and just put in a few terms, which that's the way we used to do AI in the old days, is just Google it.
And I think it comes back to the commands that a lot of that is actually under the control of the developers, particularly in terms of like hallucinations. And this is what I mentioned back at the beginning, how much it's evolving, that you can be quite strict with a program about what it is and isn't allowed to do. I think in Australia, then our scribes aren't currently allowed to make recommendations. That's something that's built in. And similarly, you can tell it in the same way that you can tell some of the online generative AI programs, you can be specific about how long you want an answer to be, that you want it to be one sentence or you want it to make three paragraphs. So I think that's sort of surmountable. But I think it is also very useful technology when you were talking about making diagnoses. Genetics and genomics, I think, is a very exciting area for AI. It does involve a lot of data and can be difficult to nail down. So when we are trying to diagnose some of these more obscure, rare genetic conditions, I think there is a real opportunity for AI in there.
Thank you so much for joining us on the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. And thank you and your team for the excellent work on this important area. And to our listeners, please join us for our next episode of the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.